From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Big changes are underway for Southwest Florida's classical music scene. The Charlotte Symphony's new music director, Rafaela Ponte, officially took the conductor's baton this past fall. Andre Boreco will become the new maestro for the Naples Philharmonic Orchestra this coming fall, and the Southwest Florida Symphony is currently in a season-long audition process in its search for a new music director. Today we'll hear our recent interview with Maestro Ponte about his background, leadership style, and emphasis on community outreach with the Charlotte Symphony. We'll also talk with leadership of the Southwest Florida Symphony about their search for a new music director and about the symphony's comeback after almost having to cancel the current season. First, this news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Southwest Florida's classical music scene is experiencing some big changes in leadership. The Southwest Florida Symphony in Fort Myers is currently on a season-long audition process in their search for a new music director. Financial constraints nearly led to the cancellation of the current season, but now ticket sales are up some 20%. We'll find out more about the symphony's comeback and the continued search for a new maestro. That conversation later in today's show. But the Southwest Florida Symphony isn't the only local orchestra seeing new faces at the podium. Maestro Andre Boreco is guest conducting a few concerts with the Naples Philharmonic Orchestra this season before taking over as music director next fall. And the Charlotte Symphony in Punta Gorda welcomed a new music director at the beginning of the current season, Maestro Rafaela Ponte. I recently sat down for a conversation with Ponte about his background, leadership style, and vision for where he hopes to take the Charlotte Symphony in the coming years. Just to start off, New York is your primary residence?
Yeah, we live, my wife, pianist Isabel O'Ben, and our little daughter Sophia, our violin player, all live in Fairport, New York, which is just outside of Rochester.
And, you know, you split your time between quite a few ambitious endeavors. In addition to being the new music director here at the Charlotte Symphony, you also conduct the Paducah Symphony Orchestra in Kentucky, the Genise Symphony in New York, the founding director of the Festival de Musica de Camera in Italy, in addition to filling guest conductor spots with prominent orchestras all over the U.S. and Europe. I guess my question would be, what made you want to take on this position here in Charlotte County with everything else you've got going on?
Well, you know, it's funny. When my agent called me and said there was an opening down here in Southwest Florida, I said, well, where? And he said, Punta Gorda. I said, well, where is that? You know, it was
yes.
One of those things. And then so we set up the audition. You know, it was one of those things where you guest conduct for the position. And he came in. And I was just absolutely amazed with what culture and what's happening down here. There's just so much going on between the visual arts, the performing arts, drama, dance, and the symphony. It's like an all-star cast of musicians. They're coming from as far as Miami to Gainesville. My concertmaster comes from Gainesville. So, you know, this affords this community to have better orchestras than they should be able to afford.
Right. It seems like there's some untapped potential here in Southwest Florida.
It's absolutely amazing.
And, you know, for symphonies, of course, this is the busy performance season. How on earth do you juggle performances with all these different groups, you know, throughout the country?
Yeah, it's 2 and 3 years out of scheduling, John. It's just about making sure the dates are available and then also scheduling guest artists, you know, working with international names like Ilya Kollar, Jeffrey Beagle, Michael Ludwig, you know what I mean? Bringing them in, they're booking 2 and 3 years out ahead themselves. So it's really just about being organized and having some foresight.
How much time do you actually get to spend here in Southwest Florida throughout the concert season?
Well, with every orchestra that I'm music director of, you spend the week of the performances there. And so it's like just get off the plane and start running right off the bat and making it happen.
And I'm going to read a quote here from David Kim, the concertmaster of the Philadelphia Orchestra, something he had written about you I'd found online. Maestro Ponte is first and foremost a wonderful and natural musician. His conducting technique is simple, clear, and uncluttered with mannerisms. Would you consider that an accurate portrayal of your conducting style? And do you think it's important for a conductor's technique to be, I guess, simple and clear?
I think our wordless impulse has to communicate so many different things to so many different people all at once. And I think being a conductor that grew up in the back of an orchestra. I was a trumpet player at 17 years old with the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra with David Zinman, and I thought I knew something then. Mm-hmm. By 19, I went to study at the Cleveland Institute of Music, CIM, and I was asked to start subbing with the orchestra my sophomore year when I turned 19, sitting next to Bernard Edelstein, the principal trumpet, who was my teacher, playing Mahler second, going to Carnegie Hall. I mean, it was like unbelievable, the dream. It's like a kid who wants to be a ball player. Finally, you're sitting on the Yankees bench looking down the line and saying, wow, that's amazing. These are the guys and gals that I wanted to play and emulate all my life. And looking at conductors, trumpet players have a lot of time to look at conductors because we have a lot of rest accounts sometimes. You know, fiddle players are working too hard to look up sometimes.
Right.
But trumpet players are back in the back row and we're analyzing what we liked, what we didn't like. Did that work? How did the orchestra react to it? And does this work for this repertoire? And I think, you know, I learned that by sitting there and saying, yes, I like this technique and I like this, and no, I don't like that. So I kind of put that into my bag of tricks. And I think being an orchestral conductor who came from the orchestra is very, very important.
Several of your contemporaries noted, and I thought that this was odd, that you make very efficient use of rehearsal time, almost as though that might be some sort of pet peeve among orchestral musicians.
Well, yeah, you know, it's a funny thing. One of these things is, you know, they don't want to hear you talk about the eighth note and how it fits into Western civilization. They want you to get to the point, make it clear, and if you cannot speak and do your job and make it all happen, the better. And I think efficiency in the rehearsal, this is where we make music. You know, the performance is really just another run-through of the final rehearsal, just all the things we've talked about and just the execution of it, the game plan. But the music making really happens in the rehearsal process. You know, it's like making a good Italian sauce. You take all these great artists, all the oboe, bassoon, French horn, and all the string players, and they're all the garlic, the basil, the onions, and they all have to be at their very best, fresh and picked and then chopped and diced perfectly. And I have a recipe which I follow these composers, beautiful recipes. They've created these masterpieces for us, and I just have to reenact this and recreate this art form. And it's about, in the rehearsal process, putting it all together. And you don't want to taste that garlic. You don't want to taste the heavy basil. But over the course of the rehearsal period of the week, you know, it simmers and becomes something better than all of us. And that's really great orchestral music making.
And you had mentioned this a bit before. Trumpet sounds like your primary instrument. You studied that at the Eastman School of Music before heading off to the Cleveland Institute of Music.
Right.
How did you first get started on the trumpet?
Well, I began as a string player. I began as a violinist.
Really?
My parents came to the United States and thought that we all should experience string instruments because that was a symbol of the orchestra and was beautiful, and I really enjoyed it. Unfortunately, I lived in a school district that decided after a few years to get rid of the string program. And that, unfortunately, is something we see all over the country, and it's not getting any better. So therefore, we had to pick an instrument because I was really gelling in music, and that was the thing that I really gravitated to. I wasn't really athletic. I wasn't necessarily a great academic student, but music gave me something that I can latch on to and gave me an identity, and I loved it right off the bat. So my folks decided, well, try playing the trumpet. And I was a little bit – I didn't care either way. I just wanted to be in the band, I guess, at that point because I wanted to be in the ensemble. And I just happened to be good at it and got better at it. But I no longer play because, you know, once I became a conductor, it was not something I could continue to do on a high level.
Sure. Sure. How did you make that transition from, you know, trumpet performer to conductor?
Yeah, you always get that question. That's a good question. And then most of my colleagues always said, why'd you make that decision?
Sure.
You know, I was fortunate having the experience in Cleveland at a pretty young age, working with a world-class orchestra. Lauren Mazzo was the conductor. I then took a one-year position in Koblenz, Germany, in the Rhein-Maselhofer Symphony at that time. And to get the European thing back in and get over there doing some German playing, rotary valve trumpets, you know, try to get that all happening. And I knew it was a one-year position. And I was like visiting my family when I had time off down in Milan and also Rome, Italy. And I met the late great conductor Giuseppe Sinopoli, who was with the Santa Cecilia Academy Orchestra at the time. And he had just started that position himself. And through the brass players, I got to meet him. I was going to all the rehearsals, and I was bringing my miniature scores, looking at things. And he's one of these conductors that I had either heard or performed a work maybe 50 times. Standard repertoire, Beethoven, Brahms, Bruckner. And when he was rehearsing it and performing it, I'm telling you, John, I heard things differently, and it was a different piece of music to me. And that intrigued me. Why and what is he doing without really talking? What is he doing to make it sound different? I was hearing different combinations of colors and instruments that I'd never heard before. It was almost as if he was an archaeologist taking this rock and chiseling away whatever he didn't need. You know, because if you go to a concert and all you're hearing is the first violins or the piccolo and the trumpet, you're not getting the full benefit of the score and what the composer wanted. We need to hear the second bassoon and the fourth horn and all these beautiful textures and colors because that's why they're there. It's not just for show. And he was able to bring out these beautiful sonorities that I'd never heard before. And that got my interest. And then he started talking and meeting me. He says, listen, you're always here. Why don't you start studying the scores with me? And he taught me solfeggio. And I had learned solfeggio in the conservatory in Cleveland, but melodically. He wanted me to solfeggio harmonically, up and down, so that I'm going from the bass, contrabass, all the way up to the piccolo on every chord. And being able to hear and develop my ear and eye also that way. So therefore, now today, I can actually look at a score and hear it without having to play through it.
That's an incredible amount of discipline.
And wow. It took a long time to do that. But it was really a great thing he taught me. And that desire to, how do you represent the composer? How do you become the advocate for the composer? And that's the goal.
You know, when you are interpreting a piece of music and you know, the emotion in it, the intensity, the passion, is it more than really looking at the score, the notes on the page, really the direction given to you by the composer, but really understanding their life and the time that they lived in as well?
You know, history, and not only their life and what was happening in their period or in their life themselves, but also what was happening artistically. Mm-hmm. You know, what kind of paintings and sculpting was being done? What kind of literature was being written? What were the political ramifications? Like for Tchaikovsky, it was not an easy life for him in that time. It was a very heavy-fisted society he was living in, and they were monitoring everything. And yet he had to be expressive, creative, and be an artist. And he was struggling with so many things on a personal note that it's amazing. His music is so passionate, beautiful, and loving. I think it's really... when you look at a piece of sheet music, you know, this dead piece of paper that's been around, could be 100 years to 200 years old, and its notation is very primitive. They tell you how loud to play, which means forte is relative. What does forte mean compared to piano? Right. I mean, is this high? Is this low? Is this? It's all relative in terms. And I think what you have to look at is what is behind the notes. And what is there, the passion there? Because it's easy to read it if you're open to it. And it's less cerebral than the passion in really hearing it. I think once you hear it. And then the other thing is that here you are now with an orchestra of 75 musicians who are going to show up at their first rehearsal. Okay, we know the notes. We know the rhythms. We know their instruments. They're all professionals. They're all masters of their craft. But they all walk in with 75 different interpretations of what this should be. And I, as a conductor, in a very short time, have to really convince them that my plan is the plan that we are going to take and then get everybody cajoled into this. And then, but you do that by being prepared, and you do that by having good musical, logical musical decisions that make sense to everyone.
And how much control as music director do you really have over the pieces that are going to be performed in any given concert series? And I ask just because, you know, as you mentioned, some of these great soloists who, you know, everybody wants to book are planning their schedules 2 and 3 years out. Do you really get to choose the programs?
Yes, and our artistic director, you do. You really do. You know, if you, for example, I just, the last performance we did, I opened with Capriccio Italian of Tchaikovsky. It was a great opener. We then brought Jeffrey Beaglin to do Rhapsody in Blue, you know, on the same program. And then I did the Giuseppe Martucci Symphony No. 1, which is a great symphony that's played in Italy all the time, but doesn't get radio time here for some reason. But it's as good as a Mendelssohn or a Brahms symphony. It's absolutely beautiful music. So when I talked to Jeffrey, you know, a year or 2 years out, the dialogue goes, listen, Jeffrey, I'm thinking of doing this. Is that going to be in your repertoire that year? You know, because solos have to have things under their fingers, and they kind of have a list of things. But a pianist or a violinist or any soloist will give you a kind of this is what I'm doing this season.
Sure.
And then you pick and choose from it. And if it's not something I want to do specifically, then I would say, okay, well, why don't we wait? Maybe I can do that next year then. You know, because it's not only about repertoire, it's about getting the right artist to do the repertoire you want to do. You know, some people you like their Mozart. Some people you like their Tchaikovsky.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the way to approach it.
In your own artistic vision, in your own words, you've stated, and I'll quote here, is to enrich lives with great orchestral music by making the orchestra relevant to everyone in the community by creating passionate, inspiring, and diverse concert events. We can inspire our community to feel all the great possibilities through great orchestral music. In your own opinion, is classical music, orchestral music, and generally battling some kind of perception of inaccessibility to the common man or some sort of art form that's really only enjoyed or appreciated by some societal elite?
Oh, boy. That's a great struggle. You know, we're fighting that in every year. I have to say, yes, I think so. It's not something new. I think all through history, it's always been something of that. You know, I mean, there was a period in time when it was the kings and queens who benefited from classical music, and this is what their entertainment tool was. It then became kind of broader based, and then it's sort of shifting again a little bit, you know. But I think you could say that about good literature,
sure,
good art films, the museums. I think people are struggling nowadays. I think we're competing with so many fast handheld devices that keep things a little bit different. But I think making the symphony relevant to the community is imperative and important for the survival of it. And one of the ways to do that is by make these educational programs.
Yes.
Here with the Charlotte Symphony Orchestra, we've just initiated an entirely new system of what we call Symphony Kids. And I'm in the schools with every third grader in the Charlotte County between November and March this orchestral season. I will spend not only time with the music kids, I'm talking about the entire third grades. So when I go into the schools, along with the art teachers and their music teachers, the program is called Art and Music, and I'm bringing in Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, the first movement, and then also one of the dances from Stravinsky's Firebird. And they're only charged with creating from a blank piece of paper something that the music says to them. And we play this super loud. It could be – sometimes it's in a cafeteria. Sometimes it's in a gymnasium. Sometimes it's outside. And it's absolutely amazing because this blank piece of paper – and these kids are looking at me like I'm speaking Italian.
Mm-hmm.
What do you want me to do again? You want me to be creative? You know, because kids are spending all day sitting there just being quiet and absorbing information.
There is no time for unstructured creativity.
That's exactly right. And now we're asking them to create something and there's no rules. So on the Beethoven page, I just say, listen, do me a favor, just do this. Draw dot, dot, dot line. And that becomes the whole first movement. Ba, 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 ba. And once that music starts, then they start going with it. And it becomes this really structured, wonderful little Germanic artwork. They don't even know why.
Mm-hmm.
Then we pause it when it's finished. Then we then put the Stravinsky on, which is Picasso at its best. You know, jagged red edges, you know, colors, different odd shapes. And the mood in the room changes because now they become more aggressive, more joyful, more hyper and loud, you know. And their colors then mix in with the Beethoven. And we end up with these incredible artworks from these third graders that we're then taking photographs of. And those images will be displayed in the concert hall when they're bussed in for the free performance in May for this program, which I'm calling Where in the World is the Symphony? And it's a 45-minute program that will include both the Beethoven Fifth and First Movement and the Stravinsky excerpt that they'll already feel like they know because they've created artwork to it. They'll be able to see their artwork at the hall that was inspired from that music. And we're going to be visiting composers from all over the world with different music from like Bizet from France, but he wrote Carmen from Spain.
Right.
And we're going to be able to touch every discipline, history, art, math, science, every curriculum is touched that way. So these third graders are becoming my friends. And then they become ultimately friends of the symphony and their parents become friends of the symphony. And that's one of the ways we're doing this by making the orchestra relevant to the community. Because now the children go home and at that performance in May, they're also going to have an experience of the instrument petting zoo where they can go around to different stations and play any instrument in the orchestra they want. You know, and now they're going to go home and say, so what did you do today? And sitting around the table and they say, Mom and Dad, I played a bassoon. Yeah. And the conversation's going to be like, well, what's a bassoon?
Yeah.
You know, and then through your kids, they're going to learn that there's a symphony orchestra that's not only just putting on great creative performances that are great cultural aspects to the community, but they're doing something nice for the kids. They're giving them an opportunity to say, third graders are thinking about next year, do I want to play an instrument? This is an excellent recruitment tool. Maybe the kids are going to want to be musicians or play in an orchestra. Another program we're doing is musical chairs. And one of my dress rehearsals in the week, the kids can actually sign up, and it's a free, again, program, can sit in the orchestra during the rehearsal. So if a flute player wants to play, sit next to the flute section, they're there. Trumpets in the trombone here, and they're dispersed all over. And these, all we put chairs all over the place. And these kids are just sitting there for this first half of the rehearsal, watching my face from the front and how I communicate with them, what I say to the musicians, how they react, and all that sound just enveloping them. They're vibrating with the clash of the cymbals. And you should see these kids. And then they get certificates, and I speak with them, and their parents are there because, you know, these are your younger kids. So this is another way of bringing the orchestra, making it relevant, and hopefully enriching lives through great orchestral music is what the symphony should be doing.
Right. Indoctrinating future generations to become great violinists and
musicians.
Yeah.
Or at least people who appreciate it because, you know, the kids have heard orchestras. If they've heard Harry Potter or any John Williams score, you know, I mean, what would a Spielberg film be without that music of John Williams? Mm. It would be flat. It would be one-dimensional. He makes those characters pop off the screen. It makes it come to life. So these kids have heard orchestras. They just haven't realized it.
Yeah, for third graders, what would a Bugs Bunny cartoon be without it?
Absolutely, you know? Right.
Well, and kind of jumping to the other end of the spectrum, I'd also read that Charlotte County is going to be expanding its summer camp program to seniors, which I think is very appropriate. Charlotte County is among actually the oldest counties in the nation when you consider the age of residents there. Is that something you're going to be involved with as well?
Absolutely. That was something that that was a challenge when I first came here because everybody talks about, you know, doing educational programs for the young, for children. But we decided to do it also for the young at heart. And one of the things we're doing is at the Renaissance in Punta Gorda, which is affiliated with the university here, mm-hmm. on Thursdays before each performance, 2 to 4, people can sign up and take this class with me. And what I'm doing is delving in and going in behind the notes is what it's called. And people can come and we're listening to recordings of what's going to be on the performance. And I compare Toscanini's version of it. And then we'll listen to Eugene Ormandy's version in Philly. How did he pace it differently? What were the tempos like? Did you notice he retarded here, but they didn't retard here, and it's not in the score? Listen to what's happening. And try to get these people to listen differently so that when they arrive at the concert hall, they're going to be feel like, A, they've got an upper hand on things. They already know the repertoire. They're going to be listening for specific things in my performance, and then they're going to witness it live and experience it live, and then we'll get together the next time and see, how did it work? What was your feeling about it? And hopefully throughout the entire season, these folks are taking this journey with me and the symphony that they're going to feel like they've been part of the artistic production and development of this entire program, entire season. And that's been really, really well received, and I'm excited about that. But, you know, this county has a lot of people that, you know, I mean, if I'm meeting people 80, 90 years old, they all played the piano. They all played in the band at some point because it was a big part of American culture back then, you know. And to return to it now that you have the time and the means to do it, mm-hmm. you know, and to do something fun, it's great socialization. It's healthy for them. And, you know, we can talk about endlessly about how great brain development and motor skills and physically how great it is for you. But it's also wonderful socially to get together and to play at any age. So we're encouraging that and we really hope to develop that program.
I think this could also interestingly develop, you know, cross-generational friendships and connections because you've got the kids who are part of the camp and then you've got the older folks who are sort of rediscovering their love of playing.
Absolutely. And it becomes this grandparenting, mentoring type of thing. And it's absolutely wonderful.
And just as far as the behind the notes classes, it just sounds like you're really fostering the creation of, you know, active listeners versus passive listeners.
Yeah, I think because if you just listen to the notes and the rhythms and the sound, you're not getting it. I think you have to really figure out why did the composer choose to do this and why did he pick that instrument? And then listen in the last movement, he brings the same theme back in, but he flips it around and why? And they start listening with that kind of idea and that kind of ear. It becomes more entertaining to listen to.
And we've kind of touched on this a bit, but how would you like to see the Charlotte Symphony grow, or how would you like to see its perception within the community change under your leadership in the coming years?
Well, the idea of growing the orchestra, we're going to expand the season already for next season. The idea, I want to make this one of the finest orchestras in this region, fully professional orchestra that is going to get out there and have a role model education program for all ages and be something to see.
And let's look ahead a little bit to some of the performances that are going to be coming up this season. The January 12th performance is going to include works by a couple of Russian composers, Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet, Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition. And this performance I found interesting in the spirit of the original inspiration for Pictures at an Exhibition, which was him, you know, looking at artwork by a friend of his. This is actually going to have photos from around Southwest Florida sort of displayed in the background while the performance plays. Is that correct?
No, it's close. Okay. What's going to happen here, we're doing the exact reverse. Yeah. Mussorgsky wrote pictures on the piano. It's a piano piece. He didn't orchestrate it at all himself.
Okay.
He wrote it for Victor Hartmann, his friend who passed away, an artist. And so when they were honoring Victor Hartmann, the gallery and the experience is what Mussorgsky wrote about him, the promenading in, mm-hmm. and the odd gait between 5, 6, and 7, 4 is not passive walking past the pictures, but him sort of staggering and looking at an amazement of his friend. And each picture was not only the artwork, but the emotion of his friend. And what we're going to be doing is the reverse of this. We've made contact with 10 professional artists in Charlotte County through the visual arts community there. And I've met with them already. We've gone through the entire piece. They've each selected a picture, one of the movements. We're doing the Maurice Ravel, the most popular, most performed one now, orchestration of it. And they are creating artwork as we speak that will be present at the hall. And the idea is not to have anything to do with Victor Hartmann's work. It's simply to take these visual artists and see what the music is saying to them and what they're creating. So this is the reverse of what had originally happened. Now the music of Mussorgsky is going to be inspiring artists, and their artwork is going to be available there and present. So it's not about seeing the process. It's about them creating artwork and then also attracting a new and diverse community to the symphony, because artists are going to want to see this. People who may not have gone to the symphony, but will be pulled in because they're supporting the visual arts community.
And let's jump ahead to the February 23rd performance. And this one I thought was particularly interesting because I had never heard of a harmonica concerto.
Yeah, you'd be surprised. I've done this before, and I've done it before with Robert Bonfilio, who is an amazing harmonica player. I mean, he's worked with the Gewandhaus Orchestra. He's been in the Concertgebouw. He's played with the New York Philharmonic, and now he's coming to the Charlotte Symphony Orchestra. And he was just here for our opening gala. And, you know, it's one of these things where you think you never know how it's going to go. And he played as a surprise guest, as a special guest at this gala, and people were on their feet with amazement because he plays it, a chromatic harmonica, like the human voice. With his vibrato, he can make it sound like a string instrument. It sounds so beautiful, like the human voice. And this Villa-Lobos concerto is absolutely a beautiful piece of music, and people will be delighted by it.
I heard the last time he performed with you conducting, or one of the last times anyway, there were so many encores, you pretty much had to just turn the lights off to get everybody to leave.
It was just before intermission. I'm telling you, he did 4 encores, and they were still wanting more. You know, we had to turn the lights on and get to the intermission. Otherwise, we'd still be there.
Well, Maestro Ponti, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for the voice of the Charlotte Symphony.
That was the Charlotte Symphony's new conductor and music director, Maestro Raffaella Ponti. He'll be conducting the symphony's next performance of Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet, Suite No. 2, and Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, Sunday, January 12th, at the Charlotte Performing Arts Center. We're taking a short break, but when we return, the Southwest Florida Symphony is in a season-long audition process for a new music director. We'll hear from members of the search committee about the process and what's at stake. That's just ahead. Stay with us. This is Gulf Coast Live on WGCU.
Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. As we continue our look at the changing face of Southwest Florida's orchestral music scene, we'll take a closer look at the Southwest Florida Symphony in Fort Myers. The organization was on the brink of canceling its current season, but now is involved in a season-long audition process for a new conductor, and ticket sales are up significantly. I recently spoke with the symphony's Vice President of Strategic Marketing and Development, Amy Padilla, along with Artistic Advisor Leif Bjaaland. In November, the Southwest Florida Symphony Orchestra's search for a new music director officially got underway, I understand. And this is going to be a season-long process throughout the current season. And tell us about the process itself. You're having candidates come down and audition by actually conducting a season-long series of performances.
Yes, we have five candidates who each will perform on a Masterworks concert. They'll be approximately a week in Fort Myers. And we're also having them meet all our many constituencies. They're going to be conducting the youth orchestra. They're going to be meeting with the Symphony Association. They're going to be meeting with, of course, the board and community groups, speaking to groups like the Kiwanis and others, and certainly to the larger constituency, the audience. They're going to be doing lectures before the performances. We want to use this as an opportunity to see them in action and to try and develop a view of them and an opinion of them and see how they would fit in, in a long-term position with the orchestra.
And in terms of the way that a professional symphony orchestra goes about conducting this kind of audition process, is this typical?
Yes. Yeah, I would say so. For orchestras of this size, it's probably the most common type of plan. Very, very large orchestras will have a large number of guest conductors. Smaller orchestras, because of the limited scope of the season or the location of the orchestra, there are many elements that play into it, often go ahead and dedicate an entire season to the search for the individual who's probably the most important person in the future of the organization, not only artistically, but in terms of the trajectory of the organization, the way they interface with the community, and the continued vitality of the artistic community in Fort Myers, and generally speaking, is heavily impacted by the music director of the orchestra.
And tell us how the search is going so far. How many candidates have come down and, spent time, conducted concerts, interacted with the community, and how many do you have left to consider audition?
We had Chelsea Tipton in November for our opening Masterworks concert, and he was very active in the community, and he made an excellent impression, I think I can say. We have four more. Amy, why don't you speak of our upcoming candidates?
We have Maestro Guillermo Figueroa, who will be here on January. Well, he'll perform on January 11th, but again, we'll spend a week in the community. I've had an opportunity to get to know most of the candidates as they arrive, and it's so interesting, the diversity and the different things that they'll bring to the community. It's just real, and just to have this audition happen in general and have these diverse candidates come in is a treat in and of itself. So we have Guillermo Figueroa coming on the 11th to perform. We have David Commenday, who is coming in mid-February. We have Andreas Delfs, who is coming on March 1st. And then we have Nir Cabaretti coming on March 29th. And so Maestro Figueroa is a Puerto Rican musician, violinist, in addition to conductor. And he's the only one who will be performing in addition to conducting. So that'll be really interesting to see. And he'll be performing a piece that was written in his honor by a Puerto Rican composer, Cordero.
And
that's a story just alone. Fascinating.
It sounds like he's going maybe a bit above and beyond there.
he's definitely bringing a unique program to Southwest Florida Symphony.
And do you have a deadline for when you want to have a decision for a new music director decided and announced?
Well, I mean, no. Actually, we have a deadline within the search committee. Incidentally, the search committee which is made up of community board members and musicians, has been working actually for almost one full year on this project, beginning with looking at something just shy of 200 resumes initially, winnowing that down, having interviews, having many discussions, looking at the videotapes and all, just a lot, a very long, I think, quite comprehensive process. And the unofficial, quote-unquote, deadline for us, I think, is June 1st.
All right.
And that that actually is a pretty tight, demanding deadline because our last candidate, Mary Cabaretti, performs with us just at the end of March, beginning of April. So we're going to endeavor, underline endeavor, to finish the process by the 1st of June, knowing full well that there's a lot of moving parts. And when you think of all these excellent conductors, they also have calendars with other orchestras with which they're associated, guest conducting dates, families. It's a lot to coordinate. So that's a pretty aggressive deadline, but I'm hopeful that we'll be able to come close to it or maybe even hit it on the nose.
And it was interesting you talked about members of the committee and it being quite a diverse group. You've got musicians in the symphony, you've got administrative staff like Amy, you, Leif, and then also patrons, members of the community as well.
Yeah, we're planning.
I think that's really important for all the stakeholders.
Yeah, agreed. And that's we're inviting the subscribers of this season to provide us with feedback on who they feel would be the best candidate, and we will take that into account because this is their orchestra too. They come to see us, and we want someone that they're going to be comfortable and happy with moving forward as well.
And do you think this process is as much an audition for the symphony as it is for the candidates? I mean, it's about, you know, you seeing if they're a good fit for your organization and our community, and vice versa, if it's a good fit for them.
Absolutely. No, I think that's totally right. It has to be a good fit for all parties, really. The five candidates are all excellent musicians and have a proven track record. And I think that one of the most important ingredients is in a successful quote-unquote marriage is that they feel the passion and the excitement of the position, that they really have something that they want to do in the community to be impactful and to help shape the larger cultural scene in Fort Myers.
Yeah, I think Leif hit that nail on the head with the word marriage. It is definitely chemistry for all involved plays a huge part in this.
And Leif, I wanted to touch on your background for a minute or two here. You left the Sarasota Orchestra after being their artistic director for some 15 years. How do you think, you know, that experience has prepared you for this, you know, very daunting role of selecting a new music director for the Southwest Florida Symphony?
Well, to be clear, it's not my decision. I'm simply guiding the committee. But I will say that there's nothing that prepares you better for something like this kind of search than to be a participant in numerous searches during the course of my career. I think the first time I was music director candidate, I was like 24. And having been part of all the searches, I've developed some views on what I think is an effective way to do the job and ways that perhaps are less effective. And so I think that I brought to this advisory capacity with the orchestra. And I'm very pleased. I think the process thus far has been extremely fruitful and effective.
And I understand you're also music director for the Waterbury Symphony in Connecticut. Of course, you're involved with us here down in Southwest Florida, and we're talking to you this morning from Seattle. Where is your primary residence anyway?
I am a citizen of the great city of Seattle, Washington.
Okay, so that is the primary residence. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And how do you manage your time with all these different, very big responsibilities that are so geographically far apart?
I'm very proud to say that I just made my 1,000,000 miles on Delta Airlines. that may be my biggest accomplishment of 2013. You have to be really adroit at traveling and keeping your mind organized when you're going from place to place, and being very cognizant of what's the next thing that you have to do, whether it be pack your bag, book a flight, or participate in a conference call. It's something that it was a challenge when I was younger to be able to do, but it's sort of kind of been built into my DNA at this point.
Mm-hmm. And that's so common in this industry for musicians and conductors to bounce from place to place, not just on a particular continent, but all over the planet. And technology has really been our friend in industry. So, yeah, it's streamlined the process.
And well, actually, the technology has definitely been our friend in terms of this process as well.
Oh, yeah.
In between Skype and email and so forth. And that probably, I would say, will continue to be an important factor as we make the decision for a new music director, because, frankly, we want somebody, as music director of the Southwest Florida Symphony Orchestra, who is in demand. We don't necessarily want a music director who is immediately free all the time. We want somebody who's playing a vibrant role in the music scene nationally and even internationally, which means that emails and schedules will be part of the mix when we create this association with our new music director.
And as members of this search committee, I want to ask each of you, what qualities are most important to you, or what are you most looking for in a new music director? And Leif, I'll start with you.
Very good question. I think in light of the fact that I think all these candidates are very qualified, and they each bring different, very positive attributes to the table, I think the most important thing is a generosity of spirit. And speaking in large terms, generosity towards the community, with their time, with their energy, to particularly the children and the youth of the community. I think one of the important missions of music directors in general at this point in time is to help develop a new and a reinvigorated association between society and symphonic music. And there's been a lot of changes in society, and the musical habits of our society have changed a great deal. So I think, you know, just playing concerts is not enough anymore. And I think music directors have to think globally and have to be able to recontextualize the symphonic music it continues to be great. There's nothing less great about Beethoven now than there was 50 years ago. But how people interact with it is vastly different. So I think also a generosity in terms of the community, in terms of the staff, being able to work and to understand the potentialities and the limitations, too, of the community and the organization and work with those. So that would be my most important attribute, considering that each one of these candidates they're excellent musicians.
Amy, you've been nodding in agreement. Is there anything you'd want to add to that?
Oh, I could not have said that any better. I think a generosity of spirit, a willingness to collaborate, an open-mindedness to creative ideas from others within the organization. And as Leif said, Beethoven, Bach, they're all as incredible and riveting as they were when they wrote the pieces they wrote, but it's the way we listen to them and the way those pieces are presented to the community as it changes and grows. And a music director who's willing to embrace new ideas on ways to do that is incredibly important.
And on the topic of that passion for community outreach. You know, something that I've spoken with many, you know, professional classical musicians and people who are in that world about is fighting this perception as classical music really only being for this particular audience or this elite audience, and really working to change its perception to make it more open and really more accessible to the broader community. I imagine that's something that's a quality you're looking for as well.
In my mind, classical music really has always been accessible to the greater community, but it is a matter of perception. I grew up with the Southwest Florida Symphony. When I moved here from the Northeast, my dad promised me he'd find me an orchestra because I missed the Philadelphia Orchestra. And lo and behold, it was the Southwest Florida Symphony that I grew up with here. So from the age of 10, I've been attending these concerts. And now that I have children of my own, they've been coming with me and I've been bringing their friends. And so it's a matter of the way I hate to use the word marketed, but it's the way what we do is demonstrated to the community at large, that this is not for a limited, older, wealthy audience. This is for everybody, and it will touch you if you attend a concert. Hearing live symphonic music, there is nothing like it.
And you know, Amy, I know you haven't been with the organization for too terribly long, just a few months now, but tell us perhaps how your expectations have been different from the reality you've experienced working with the Southwest Florida Symphony.
It's hard for me to believe that there was ever an issue. Our ticket sales are up about 20% across the board this season thus far, and that's even for upcoming concerts, not the performances that have passed. There are lines at the box office. Our phone rings consistently, and the feedback from the community is overwhelmingly positive. They obviously love having and need to have a professional symphony orchestra in our community.
Yeah, again, you alluded to it. It is no secret the symphony did face some challenges. At one point, it looked like the current season might have to be canceled. Tell us about those challenges and how the symphony has sort of made this comeback.
Well, again,
It is amazing.
But I'm not terribly surprised, frankly. When the community, not just with a symphony, but with any institution, I mean, we've been here for over a half century. So to run the risk of losing an institution like Lee County's only professional symphony orchestra, and the community is faced with that, everyone rallied. Everyone came to its rescue and said, absolutely not. We will not be without a professional orchestra. And that had a snowball effect. And now people, as I said, are buying tickets and are wanting to learn more and are attending events that the symphony has. It's a very, very good feeling. I'm so proud and so honored to be working with this organization.
And I know
Let me just add that
yes.
There was one very, very important person, I think, in the turnaround who I really cannot say enough about in terms of institutional gratitude, and that is William Larson, our principal flute, who I think at the point where people were seriously contemplating canceling the season, started a single-handed fundraising project online and through his connections in the community, and has many, many connections. He's very, very heavily involved in the community and has been for these 30 years. He's been principal flute. And His fundraising outreach was proved so successful that I think it really inspired the rest of the board to fight and work and energize the community. I refer to him as our spark plug. Now the nickname has been shortened to Sparky. So if you see Bill Larson,
yeah.
Tell him hi, Sparky, and I think he'll probably break into a big smile.
All right. Well, and looking back at that difficult time, there was that $200,000 debt the symphony faced. Administrative staff was consolidated, moved into lesser expensive offices. But you're telling me it wasn't just these cost-cutting measures. It was really fundraising and community support that's brought the group back to life.
Yes.
Without question.
Without question is true. And Bill really did spearhead all of that. Anyone who spends any time on the internet and lives anywhere in our five-county area saw his campaign, 30 for 30, and he raised an awful lot of money and certainly a lot of awareness, positive awareness, reminding people that if they don't support, then the Southwest Florida Symphony goes away, and that obviously our community did not want that to happen.
Well, if you're listening, thanks, Sparky. you know, this process of looking for a new music director, you know, as we've mentioned, it can take years sometimes, and making the wrong decision can make or break an organization. I mean, as you're doing this, auditioning these folks, do you kind of feel like you have that weight on your back, like perhaps making the wrong decision might put the organization back in jeopardy?
Well, that's a very good point. I think we have a very clear picture of the kind of person we do want. However, things, the world is fluid, and it's certainly conceivable that the candidate who would be top on our list at the end of this project might get a job somewhere else, or suddenly, for whatever reason, become unavailable. And I think the committee is mindful of that possibility, but hey, life is full of unexpected possibilities, and I think we go forward now with a sense of mission and with also a lot of excitement at the possibility that this could be a marriage made in heaven and a perfect match. And we're going to do everything as a committee and as an organization to make that a reality.
And we certainly have five very desirable bachelors, so as it were, to choose from. So, we almost really can't go wrong with any of these guys.
And we've mentioned, you know, some of the performances coming up with future candidates throughout this season. But are there any other concerts or opportunities that you would want to highlight throughout the rest of this season?
Yes,
there is one.
Oh, go ahead.
There is one that I certainly would want to do. And Amy will probably, I'm going to need to ask you to help me with the dates, but we're doing a program that I'm going to be conducting called Mozart the Miraculous, which is a multimedia program sort of describing the journey that Mozart made as he composed the Jupiter Symphony, his final symphony, Symphony No. 41 in C major. And it involves the Ave Maria chorus and solo singers, the orchestra, visuals, actors. It's I think going to be a real experience for the audience.
And that happens January 22nd at Shell Point Village and January 23rd on Sanibel at Big Arts.
Well, Amy Padilla and Leif Bialin, thank you so much for speaking with us today, and best of luck on your continued search for a new music director for the Southwest Florida Symphony.
Thank you.
Thanks, John. It's a pleasure.
That was Vice President of Strategic Marketing with the Southwest Florida Symphony, Amy Padilla, along with Artistic Advisor Leif Bialin. That's all the time we have for today's show. There's more information on today's program, as well as an archive of past shows at our website, wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. To comment on anything you've heard on this or any edition of the show, send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Thanks to my producers Luke Martin and Richard Chinqui. This is WGCU Fort Myers 90.1 FM, WMKO Marco 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.